Good morning, we're the Historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the Electronic Charles.
Nice. Now, last week, you mentioned that there are bobcats living basically within a stone's throw of your palatial estate in West Roxbury.
There are bobcats living in West Roxbury for sure, and I do think there's one right nearby where I'm living, yes.
But you haven't seen one yourself yet.
I did hear it in there, and I think I told you about that. Remember I told you about that, hearing it up there? And it wasn't a coyote, and it was something was attacking a turkey, which, of course, I saluted it for assisting in clearing the neighborhood. I haven't seen any turkeys around here lately. but there's definitely one that somebody took a picture of in West Roxbury in Millennium Park.
You know? Yeah. You know, you've always been fascinated by wildlife. I am fascinated by it, too, but I think you are more fascinated by it, even. It's interesting, growing up in New Jersey, and you are extremely focused in on. I get like 7 emails from you at least every week on various wildlife issues.
New Jersey, incidentally, has both bobcats and bears.
Oh, yeah. The largest bear in the U.S. was shot
black
in...
Largest black bear in U.S. history was shot in New Jersey.
And did you notice that our friend and colleague from Brown, Walt Stevenson, sent us an email recently showing this giant landlocked salmon that was caught in New Jersey?
I have stories about that, which I won't bore our listeners with, but I will bore you with after we're done today, because there is stuff to say about that.
All right. Well, you know what I wrote him back to that was that salmon was 26 inches long. I said it's exactly the same size as the trout I caught on a dry fly in the Tweed River. Take that,
Walt Stevens.
Well, all right. So what are we having for breakfast this morning?
I am having, once again, I'm going to the swine in my bacon. I'm not a huge sausage person. I do want to share that with our audience. Yeah. I do like bacon, but not huge on sausage, breakfast sausages.
Too many unknown things in sausage for you.
Yes. I am also having a salt bagel. From my new bagel destination, they sell bagel with salt on it, which has now become transgressive in the current American dietary regime in the Boston area, because salt is bad for you, as you know.
Oh, really?
So a lot of places don't sell salt bagels anymore.
Oh, I'm not paying a lick of attention to that.
And I'm having some cranberry juice to clean the internal McConville. Yeah, you know,
antioxidant.
Antioxidants, yes.
In honor of our discussion of salmon and fishing right now, I'm going to have something that I have for breakfast in the UK and in Scotland quite regularly, which is salmon, smoked salmon with scrambled eggs.
Wow.
I love it. It's such a great combination. And sometimes they mix the salmon up into the eggs. And sometimes
have you ever thought about living in Scotland? I can see you
absolutely
being Scottish.
I would live there. I am, at least part.
Right.
It is a sad thing about the country that everyone there does look like me. I apologize for mentioning that. I have thought very seriously about it. It's not easy to do. If you don't have UK citizenship, it is very difficult. So
interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
But someday, maybe someday. A castle is what I want there. You know, it can be small.
Yeah. Small. And you deserve it.
Thank you. There's no doubt I deserve it. I mean, a small castle in Scotland. Well, I don't know how I segue now back to the Persian Wars. We're in our third and final episode of this special 3-part treatment of the Persian Wars in honor of the 2,500-year anniversary of the end of the Persian Wars in 479 BC and the 200th anniversary of the beginning of the Greek War for Independence and the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. We are talking about the Persian Wars, and it's been quite a set of wars so far, wouldn't you say?
It has been quite a set of wars, and us discussing it in these segments can in no way capture the scale and the drama and the human suffering and the awesome, forces unleashed by these wars, because this leads to the rise of Athens and it leads to the Peloponnesian War. I mean, there's no doubt, as well as leads to a lot of other things, like, for example, the revolt in Egypt and the Persian reaction to it in Egyptian history. It's just tremendous.
It also prevented the Persians from moving further west and perhaps stalling the Greek development And maybe stalling what else went on in the West, which was, of course, the rise of Rome. The Mediterranean world would have looked completely different had the Greeks not won these wars, and no one could have expected them to win. But I'm glad you brought this up about our episodes compared with, say, the Count of Herodotus, because a lot of what I'm saying is critical of Herodotus, but that work is a masterpiece, and you all should go read it. And read Aeschylus's play, The Persians, which is quite surprisingly sympathetic to the Persian plight. It's certainly pro-Greek, but it understands that Persians were just human beings. It doesn't treat them as two-dimensional figures the way
it does not demonize them. If you've ever read the Persians, it just doesn't.
It's not a Bruce Willis movie or a Steven Seagal movie where we have bad guys and perfectly bad and perfectly good guys. That's not the way the Greeks saw the world.
I read this 41 years ago.
I was just going to ask.
At Herodotus and the Persians.
Was it part of the Hume 110 curriculum?
Hume 110 curriculum. And I have to say, it has remained with me from that time to this time. I mean, it's so profound.
It's one of the subjects you and I have discussed most over our 35-year friendship. This Star Trek.
Fishing.
Those are probably the top three.
And several other things that we're not going to acknowledge at this time. Right.
Well, what happened after the Greeks won the Battle of Salamis, the Greek allies, is that the Persians, Xerxes, the great king, pulled his navy out of Greece, pulled them back to Asia Minor, and he left his infantry in central Greece, or at least a large part of it, under the commander Mardonius, who was the son-in-law of Darius. So he was Xerxes' brother-in-law. And he left about 300,000 men in central Greece who spent the winter of 380-79 hanging around in central Greece. And you want to know where they spent some of their time?
Thebes.
Yeah, exactly. And this was the moment at which I'm imagining the Thebans thought, maybe we didn't choose the right side in this war. We just lost the Battle of Salamis, and now we've got hundreds of thousands of Persians floating around in the center of Greece.
And there's no guarantee we're going to win. What they may retreat, and then the other Greeks are going to come looking for us.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you know,
I would think it would make you quite nervous to have a Persian army of that size floating around in central Greece. Well, Herodotus tells us that there were negotiations going on in this winter, and that one thing that happened was the king of Macedon, whose name was Alexander, just like the later Alexander of Macedon, this king of Macedon came down to Athens, and he negotiated with the Athenians on behalf of the Persians and basically said, why don't you guys come over to our side? All right. And Herodotus tells us that the Spartans were present in Athens. I'm sure they were there you know, making plans for the next campaign, or what are we going to do in the spring? And Herodotus has the Spartans make this speech in which they say, hey, Athens, it would be wrong of you to join the Persians because, you know, we're all Greeks and we worship the same gods and we speak the same language. And, you know, just wouldn't be a good thing if you joined the Persians. And the Athenians' response in Herodotus is to make this indignant speech in which they say, how dare you think that we, of anybody, would ever join up with the Persians when we fought the Persians at Marathon, and we would never, ever, ever, last thing we would ever do is make peace with the Persians. Now, the funny thing about this is that Herodotus's readers in the 420s, let's say,
knew
that the Athenians had made some kind of peace, whether it was a formal peace or an informal peace. The Athenians had made some kind of arrangement with the Persians. So to hear the Athenians making this highly ironic speech about how they'll never go over to the Persian side. It's Herodotus is, he knows what he's doing here, I think. But so the arrangement that Spartans and the Athenians make, what they actually say is the Spartans say, yes, we'll come up and fight the Persians with you. And the Athenians, in Herodotus, they say, well, you need to come up and save Athens, come up and fight so that Athens doesn't get sacked again. But of course, they're not going to save Athens because it's already been sacked. It was sacked in 480. And so the plan is clearly that the Athenians are going to do exactly what they did in 480, pull their people to Salamis, right? That's exactly what happens, okay? So, but Herodotus presents this fantasy story of the Athenians sending in the spring of 479, sending a embassy down to Sparta and saying to the Spartans, putting their hands on their hips and saying, you Spartans haven't sent the army up north yet, like you said. And if you don't send the army up north, guess what? We're going to go over to the Persian side. So within like five pages of Herodotus' history, the Athenians go from saying, we'll never go over to the Persian side, to saying, we're going to go over to the Persian side. If you know, of course, and then the Spartans do this crazy thing where they wait for 10 days before they actually send the army out. And they keep telling the Athenians, we'll talk about this tomorrow. We don't want to talk about this today. We'll talk about this tomorrow. And then on the 10th day, in the middle of the night, the Spartans send out the largest force they've ever sent, 5,000 Spartan hoplites and seven helots for every Spartan hoplite. So 35,000 helots. And all these forces managed to march out of Sparta in the middle of the night without anybody knowing about it. The Athenians get up the next morning. They go to the Spartan ephors, the leaders of Sparta, and say, are you guys going to send the force north or not? And the Spartans go, they're already on the way. And the Athenians are like, what? You know, and they, so it's just a comical story, you know, it's impossible to accept on its face. What are the facts? The Spartans sent the largest force they ever sent out of the Peloponnese to fight in central Greece, okay? So I don't want to hear it from people who say the Spartans weren't committed to defending Greece. I mean, this is ludicrous.
I've heard that number at 8,000, but it's lower, you think?
5,000. Herodotus gives the number 5,000. The Athenians have 8,000 at Plataea. Maybe that's what you're thinking about.
Maybe that. Yeah. Perhaps I confuse those numbers now, yes.
Yeah. So, and what do the Athenians do? They pull their people to the island of Salamis. Mardonius, the Persian, comes in and sacks Athens exactly as he did in 480. But I've always thought the second sacking of a city must be
disappointing.
Really very disappointing. I mean, right. You know, I already sacked this house. You know, what do you got here? It's dog food. You know, I don't know. Anyway, but Athens is sacked again. And then Mardonius pulls his force up into central Greece, into Boeotia,
right,
south of the city of Thebes, north of the city of Plataea. Why did he bring his army there? Because there was a nice, big, flat area where he could use his cavalry, his mounted archers.
Right.
And you need flat ground for cavalry, especially when you don't have horseshoes.
right.
And so he pulls to this defensive position south of Thebes, across this river, on the north side of a river called the Aesopus River, and they build a huge fortified camp there that Herodotus says was a mile square, okay? Big enough to hold 70 or 80 or 100,000 men at least. And they occupy this defensive position, just inviting the Greeks, come on, you know, and fight us here. Spartans march up north. Athenians now send their forces north. Some other Greek states join in. Corinthians are there. Megarians are there, as I recall. The Plataeans, of course, fight on the side of the Greeks. And the Greeks have about 100,000 or 110,000 men, including the lightly armed troops like the helots. So maybe 70,000 hoplites, 60,000 hoplites, and 40 or 50,000 lightly armed troops. The first thing that the Greeks do is they occupy a position in the foothills.
Where the horse can't operate.
Exactly.
The horse cannot operate in that low, scruffy hill country.
Exactly. And they're south of the Aesopus River, okay? So they're in the higher ground, this broken ground, and they're basically saying to the Persians, you know, come on and attack us here. You know, you won't be able to use your horses, but come on and do it. Of course, you'll have to cross that river to attack us.
We're not
going to cross it to attack you. So maybe we leave the Greeks there in that position in those hills, and then we'll come back to fight the battle.
We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back with our final special episode on the Persian Wars. We're the historians.
Okay. So we'll do 453 plus 14, which gets us to 507. 453 to 507. I just gave a talk on this battle a few days ago.
Interesting, because my recollection of this is somewhat different in terms of the numbers involved, which the basic structure of it I understand, but the numbers, I think I had the Greek numbers smaller in my head for some reason overall.
Well, the reason that 5,000 sticks in my head is because it's seven men for each Spartan, and you get to 35,000 that way. So,
right.
You know, there's an article, actually, one guy postulates that the number seven comes from each Spartan holding the front of the line, and then seven helots behind him, making eight. That's a clever idea. I think it's totally unworkable, but anyway, explains the number. Okay. All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the Battle of Plataea in 479 BC. We left the Greek forces in the foothills to the east of Plataea and south of Thebes. They were being harassed in that position, and some of the Greeks were exposed, right? There wasn't enough protected ground in those foothills. And at one point, I want to say it was the Megarians who sent a message to the Spartan commander, who was Pausanias of Sparta, who was regent of Sparta, not actually king, but commanding on behalf of his nephew, who was too young. And the Megarians say, look, we're getting torn up down here by these Persian archers, you know. And the Spartans actually send a special unit of Athenians who go down to relieve the Megarians. And this is the first example of many of Spartans and Athenians cooperating in this battle. So ultimately, the Greeks decide that this position in the foothills is not the best position for them, and they take a position along some ridges that are south of the Aesopus River. So high ground south of the Aesopus River. The Persians are still in the flat lands to the north of the Aesopus River. And at this point, Herodotus tells us that both sides consulted their soothsayers, their mantes, their priests, and they were taking, you know, auspices, or it's not auspices because it's not birds, but anyway, examining the entrails of their animals. And he says both sides' priests said, we can win this, but only if we adopt a defensive plan. In other words, they have to attack us. And of course, since that river is between the two sides, you see why the priests were not fools, you know, make them cross the river and we'll attack them when they're crossing the river, you know, make them come up on this high ground for the Greeks. So we have a period of about 8 to 10 days here where there's no fighting. There's the Persians, you know, raiding across the river with their archers. The Greeks more Greeks were showing up. So the Greeks are trying to, you know, build up their numbers as more Greeks show up. But Herodotus tells us that both sides were in trouble in terms of supplies, that they couldn't just stay camped where they were forever. They didn't have the supplies to do that. And what happens is that the Persians manage to get a raiding party over and spoil the spring that supplied the water to most of the Greek forces. Now, the Spartans were on the side of the line, the right side of the line that guarded that spring. But this leads to a conference about what are we going to do? You know, we need a new water supply. And the Greeks decide that they will withdraw. They will pull back to a place that Herodotus calls the island. The island was a part of land around Plataea where a river split and then rejoined. And that island is in the middle of the river. Okay.
Right.
And of course, there wasn't enough room on this island for all of the Greek forces, but that somehow was going to be the anchor of at least one end of the line. And of course, this would be well-watered place that have a good water supply. And the Persians would have to cross that river. This river is called the Oiroe River. The Persians would have to cross that river to attack. So I should have mentioned that there is an account in this part of the history where Herodotus says that the Spartans go to the Athenians and say, listen, you Athenians have fought the Persians before, and we're opposite the Persians in the battle line right now. You guys are opposite the Thebans. So why don't we switch sides? And we Spartans will go over and we'll fight the Thebans, and you Athenians will fight the Persians. Now, if you can imagine the Spartans making this kind of suggestion.
It seems unlikely.
Okay, but the Athenians go, sure, we'll do that. So they switch sides. The Persians see that the Spartans and Athenians have switched sides. So the Persians switch sides. So the Persians are now on the Persian right, and the Thebans are on the Persian left. The Spartans see the Persians switch, and they send a message back to the Athenians and say, hey, they switched. We need to switch back. So the Spartans and Athenians switch back again. Persians and Thebans switch back again, and everybody ends up exactly where they started. Yeah? And that's where that's the way the battle is going to be fought. But this is just an example of how Herodotus' account is full of anti-Spartan propaganda. You know, the Spartans were afraid of the Persians, he literally says. the Persian commander taunts the Spartans at this point and says, "Hey, Spartans, you guys are too scared to fight us. You know, what a bunch of chickens you are. How about this? You choose, you know, 300 men and we'll choose 300 men or some number. And we'll settle this all in a battle of champions." And Herodotus says, "And the Spartans made no answer to this proposal." Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. Seems unlikely.
Imagine the Persians with a 3-to-1 advantage suggesting that we fight it out on equal terms, you know.
Right.
Okay, they make this plan that during the night they will pull back to the island, all right? But it's clear, Herodotus doesn't present it this way. I'm just going to give you my interpretation, all right? Pausanias, the Spartan commander, knew that if they did this withdrawal of 70,000 men, say 60,000 men, that some Greeks were going to have to continue to face the Persians, right? And cover that withdrawal. You can't just everybody turn your back to the Persians and start walking away. So the plan I suggest was that the Athenians would cover the withdrawal on the left and the Spartans would cover the withdrawal on the right. The other Greeks would pull back to the island. What happens in the middle of the night is that the other Greeks do pull back. They don't actually go to the island. This is a problem. They end up going back to Plataea, almost to the city of Plataea itself. Nobody knows why. Somebody was confused. Try to move 100,000 men around at night and something, you know, confusion may very well happen. But the Spartans, after the other Greeks withdraw and the Spartans and the Athenians have covered this withdrawal, the Spartans begin to withdraw. And then one of the Spartan commanders, I'm sure you know this story, one of the Spartan commanders refuses to pull his unit out.
Right.
And Pausanias sends him a message and says, "What are you doing? Don't you remember the plan? We're supposed to pull back to the island now." And the guy says, "I'm not doing it. I'm not retreating in front of the foreigners," he says. Right. That's not what we do. Right. You know, right. "I'm not going to retreat. Let's fight these guys." So Pausanias actually has to go to this guy and he starts arguing with him. The Athenians, meanwhile, send a message to the Spartans, and the message is, "Hey, aren't we supposed to be withdrawing now? What are you guys doing?" And the Spartans' message back to the Athenians is just do what we do. If we stay, you stay. If we go, you go. Herodotus says that the Athenians, knowing the Spartans didn't tell the truth, sent this message, this request. I mean, no, the Athenians did what any normal commanders would do. "What are you guys doing? What's the plan?" Okay. And that's what they do. The Athenians and the Spartans stay in their position. You know, at one point, this guy, Amompharetus, the Spartan commander who refuses to go, he picks up this huge rock. I always imagine that Bill Murray thing where he's picking up the Hercules guy. He picks up this huge rock and he puts it down because they voted with stones, you know?
Right.
He puts it down and he says, "With this stone, I vote not to retreat in front of the foreigners."
Right.
So Pausanias finally just says, "I can't do anything with this guy," and just starts to pull his men out because he thinks Amompharetus will eventually follow us when he sees that we're actually leaving. And that's, in fact, what happens. The guy's like, "Okay, they're really going to leave." So the Spartans start to pull out. The Athenians now start to pull out, and that's when the Persians attack. All right. Spartans and the Athenians there's a distance between them. Okay.
There's a gap in the line
There's a gap in the line. The Thebans attack the Athenians on the left side of the Persian line. The Persians attack the Spartans on the right side of the Spartan line. And this is the moment. Of course, the Persians are using arrows, okay? They've got mounted archers. They build a little wickerwork wall with their shields, Herodotus says, and they're just pummeling the Spartans. Well, why aren't the Spartans fighting back? Because Pausanias is trying to get his priests to give him good entrails,
good omens,
right? Exactly. Right. So they're killing, you know, sheep left and right, looking at the livers or the kidneys or whatever, and they're getting bad omens, and they can't fight back. I mean, the Spartans are scrupulous about religious matters. This is the perfect example of that. The Spartans are literally taking casualties without fighting back. And finally, Pausanias, according to Herodotus, looks at the temple of Hera and Plataea and calls out to the goddess and says, "You got to help us," you know. And then they get good omens, and they attack. And of course, when they attack, this wickerwork wall of the Persians
collapses,
just crushes it. You know?
Right.
And the Persians, when they're meeting these Spartan hoplites, you know, they're quickly turning tail and fleeing.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Thebans, who are very good soldiers, and the Athenians are fighting it out on the left wing, and there the Athenians are having a hard time of it. The Spartans at one point send a message to the Athenians and say, hey, we're getting pummeled by arrows over here. You guys have some archers. Please send us your archers. I think this request for sending archers is the story, is the basis for all this stories about
flip-flopping stories exactly. about switching right. sides. Right. Yeah.
So what the Athenians do is they send a message back and say, we can't because we're under attack ourselves from the Thebans, you know. And Herodotus' account really makes it look like the Athenians felt bad that they couldn't send their archers. They wanted to. Well, now, the crucial thing that happens at the Battle of Plataea, in my opinion, is that the Persian center never engages. The Persian center was commanded by a guy named Artabazus. He has advised Mardonius, the Persian commander, not to fight under these conditions. He kept suggesting, excuse me, we should pull back to Thebes. And what I think happened is that Artabazus, the way that the topography is, I won't try to describe the topography in any detail, but let me just say that Artabazus was further away from the Greeks than the other Thebans and the Persians were. And I think that the Persians and the Thebans were already engaged when he crossed that river and got to the battlefield in the center. And what he saw was the Persians losing to the Spartans. And I think he decided, this is over. We've lost. And he turned around and took it to the north. He escaped with 40,000 men.
Yeah, to Thebes. He went to Thebes, right?
And then further north. He never engaged. Had they engaged, it might have gone very differently because then the Athenians and the Spartans could have been outflanked. Right, from that center position.
Right, they could have turned. Yeah. You look at the campaigns of Alexander. The key is always open a hole in the center of the line and then envelop on both sides.
Yep, exactly. And Artabazus not engaging is very likely to be the turning point in this battle. the Persians, the Spartans chase the Spartans and the Tegeans chase the Persians back to their camp. And then they get to this fortified camp across the Aesopus River. And the Spartans are very bad at sieges. And they wait for the Athenians to show up. And the Athenians then, you know, manage to get into the camp. And they just slaughter the Persians.
So the Athenians survived the Theban assault, in other words.
Yes.
But it was close fought.
It was. And imagine the Athenians already dislike Thebans intensely. And the Thebans dislike. Imagine their feelings about each other after this battle.
Yeah, not friendly and warm.
Not too friendly.
Not friendly and warm. So in the wake of the battle, do we know what the losses were on each side?
No. I don't believe Herodotus gives total losses here, but he implies. He does actually, I believe he does tell what the Spartan numbers were, and they were incredibly small. I want to say under 100.
And so then at that point, the Persian army and its Greek auxiliaries, they withdraw towards the north and the north to the northeast, correct? Those that had survived. They're trying to get out of there, get away from the Spartans.
Yeah, Herodotus implies that it's very few more than the 40,000 with Artabazus that actually escaped the Battle of Plataea.
Wow. That's a lot of dead people.
Yeah, I'm sure some were taken captive and treated as slaves. And, you know, a funny thing that happens at that camp, Pausanias, the Spartan king, takes in, collects a bunch of the gold and silver plate and fancy stuff that the Persians have and their food and everything. And he makes the Persian cooks put on a meal and he invites the other Greek commanders. And they eat this amazing Persian food off all this fancy, cutlery and everything. And Pausanias says, imagine if you had this kind of stuff in your country and you want to come take away what we have. We're eating this gruel, this famous Spartan gruel. He made him prepare a Greek meal too, a Spartan meal too. So the two things were side by side. He says, imagine you got this.
And when you have gruel. We're coming up on our second break. We'll be right back with the historians. That is funny. That's hilarious. I'd heard that before, but I'd forgotten that story.
It's a
kind of it must be true. It must be true,
Of course. And it's this kind of a theme of Herodotus that why would a rich country want to invade a poor one? What do you have to gain?
You do wonder about that.
Yeah, exactly.
The Peloponnese is arid, right? Yeah. there, as you pointed out in the earlier episode, there aren't fields and fields of wheat. Like,
exactly.
You know? Exactly. All right. So we're going to go from what? 508?
508 to 514.
508, 522.
Right. Okay.
522.
All right. All right. We're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the Persian Wars. But before we get back, Professor McConville, very important, return historical sponsor, the Adams and Jefferson School of Conflict Resolution, Arbitration, and Mediation. Now, Brendan, you and I have been friends for a long time. You know, it's over 35 years now.
Yes, I do.
Can you believe that? And we've had, we've had very few serious conflicts over that time, although we've argued about everything from labor unions to the Civil War. I mean, the War of Northern Aggression. But have you ever thought about what we would do if we had a really serious disagreement?
Yes, I have.
Okay, well, maybe it would include consulting our historical sponsor, the John Adams and Thomas Jefferson School of Conflict Resolution, because that school is prepared to help resolve any and all major disputes, even those between Northern Irish Catholics and Southern Scots Calvinists.
You know, as an early American historian, I thought of them first.
Good. Founded on July 4th, 1826, the Adams and Jefferson School has been helping persons of all walks of life resolve serious conflicts for almost 200 years. The school takes its name and its mission from the tempestuous relationship between founding fathers John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who infamously argued over everything from the nature of man to the need for a standing army and national bank to the right of a state to nullify federal legislation and whether Dolly Madison was hot, Jefferson pro, Adams con. But as many people know, Adams and Jefferson were able to mend their strained relationship later in life through the help of their friend and intermediary, Benjamin Rush, a fascinating and extensive correspondence, and a mutual love of whist, the card game that so dominated early 19th century parlors and Jane Austen novels. Now, students at the Adams and Jefferson School proceed through a curriculum that emphasizes the development of useful tools like empathy, rationalism, and adult beverages as necessary means for helping us not only tolerate, but even to learn to love our fellow men, even if they are, quote, arrogant, wine-swilling frogs, as Adams once called Jefferson, or, quote, pseudo-monarchist Yankee prigs, as Jefferson said of Adams. Graduates of the school are eligible for an advanced program called the Burr-Hamilton track, although only 50% of those who enter this program survive to completion. So, if you continue to have unresolved issues with a friend, frenemy, coworker, or significant other, contact the Adams and Jefferson School today and begin the journey to a happier personal constitution.
Adams and Jefferson School, declare your independence.
Your independence from conflict, even. I mean,
exactly. Yeah,
these guys were amazing, you have to say. What a friendship. What a friendship. They died on that day, July 4th, 1826, you know.
July 4th, 1826. The book about their friendship in old age, written by our friend and former teacher, Gordon S. Wood, last year came out.
I'll have to read that book. That would probably be worthwhile. I'm sure you and I will be exchanging angry Zoom calls and heated messages.
right.
50 years in. We're almost there. In 35 right, years. Almost,
not to worry, listeners. I will correct his views about the Civil War eventually.
what an arc that's going to be. When we do that Civil War arc, it's going to be amazing. Well, okay. So Battle of Plataea is one. Now, we don't want to forget that there was also a Greek fleet involved, but they were fighting on the eastern side of the Aegean. Herodotus tells us that the Greek fleet met the Persian fleet on the same day as the Battle of Plataea at a mountain on the western coast of Asia Minor called Mycale. Now, this is just across the water from the island of Samos. So this is southwest Asia Minor. We don't know a lot about this battle. It's not nearly as well documented as Plataea. But, excuse me, the Greek fleet was trying to engage the Persian, which means Phoenician/Greek fleet. And what happens at Mycale, by the way, this is August, late August of 479 in all likelihood. What happened at the Battle of Mycale is that the Persians had built a fortification on land there. And it's, for some reason, they decided to pull their ships up and to basically invite the Greek fleet to meet them on land. Now, Herodotus doesn't have a very good explanation for this, but I suspect the reason was that in that camp, they had infantry supporting their navy. And they thought, if we can get this Greek fleet to land, we'll be fighting not hoplites, but mainly rowers. Because each trireme usually only has, say, 10 to 30 hoplites on board as Marines, okay? Now, this is a theory. I've never read this theory. I don't know anybody else has ever propounded this, all right? I just think it's a possibility.
They feared hoplites because of the armor, the heavy armor.
Right.
The fighting skill of the hoplites, they feared that.
And they knew the Greeks were fighting well on water because they had lost the Battle of Salamis. So how can we turn this situation to our advantage? Let's get these guys out of their ships. They're a bunch of rowers, and we'll meet them on land. Just a hypothesis. What happens during the Battle of Mycale is that the Herodotus tells us this, that the Greeks that were fighting on the Persian side desert to the Greek side. Yeah. And this creates, obviously, a problem for the Persians. The other problem was that apparently there were more hoplites than they counted on in the Greek ships.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Exactly.
Yeah. They come pouring off those ships, right?
Who are those guys with the big shields, you know?
That's right. The armor, the heavy body armor, right?
Oh, no. You know, like facepalm for the Persians. In short, the Greeks defeat the Persians at Mycale, and the Persian fleet ceases to exist as an effective force in the Eastern Aegean as a result of this battle.
Wow.
Yeah. The Persians who managed to get back to Asia Minor, including Artabazus and his gang, some of them anyway, they had no support from a fleet. You know, they were stranded. Those Persians in Greece.
They had to march back, in other words.
Exactly. Like Xenophon's forces getting out after the Anabasis in 401 BC.
They're lucky to have gotten out of there.
Very lucky.
Very lucky.
Yeah.
Did the Athenians then, or the Greeks then, mount a counteroffensive against the Greeks in into Asia Minor?
Well, what a great question. That's a perfect segue. Yeah. What happens is that they decide that the Spartans, so Spartans are in command at Mycale, just like they were in command at Plataea. And they decide, the Spartans, that what we're going to do is we're going to sail up to the Hellespont and smash the bridges there that allowed the Persians in. So either we'll keep more Persians from coming into Europe, or we'll keep the Persians who are in Europe so we can kill them.
Pardon
bless
me.
You. But when they get up there, they find out that the bridges have already been destroyed. The bridges have already been destroyed by a storm, as I recall. And here's something very interesting happens. The Spartans say, okay, we're going to go home. This is over. Time to go home. The Spartans go back to the Peloponnese, and the Athenians go, you know what? We're just going to kind of hang out here for a while.
Now, remember, in Asia Minor.
The Athenians had interests in the Hellespont. They've had interest for 100 years before this. So the Athenians stay up there and do some campaigning, take a strategic location called Sestos. This is, it's Pericles' father, Xanthippus, who's in command of these Athenian forces. So I'm just pointing out the Athenians, as soon as they got a chance to reacquire territory up there in the Hellespont region, they do it. All right. Right.
No, it's hardly surprising given their interest in the Black Sea, the grain trade.
Exactly. And the Spartans clearly don't have any problem with them doing that. Now, I should have pointed out that before they went up to the Hellespont, the Spartans and Athenians and the other Greeks had a meeting on the island of Samos. And at that meeting, the Spartans made a proposal. You Greeks of Asia Minor need to come back to the mainland. We cannot protect you over here. Okay, we can't be sending forces all the way across the Aegean to protect you from the Persians, and you're exposed to them. Okay, they're right here in Asia Minor. That's not as dumb a proposal as Herodotus makes it sound. Okay,
not at all.
No, it's actually, it has a lot of sense. The Athenians, though, say to the Ionian Greeks, no, we understand you've been there for hundreds of years. We support your right to stay here in Asia Minor. Of course, within 10 years, the Athenians are going to be ruling those Greek states and collecting the tribute from them that the Persians were collecting.
Don't they make an argument? They say, we understand you want to tend the grave of your ancestors and maintain your altars to your gods. Is all thinking. Yep. Meanwhile, they're all thinking, we want to conquer you and make you pay tribute to us.
I mean, that would be the cynical interpretation. And I think there's some merit to it here.
Right.
But the Spartans, again, just say, okay, that was our idea. And they go back. You know, they go back to the Peloponnese and they do Spartan stuff. You know, they're not running around in fleets. They don't care about the Athenians running around to the Aegean. Go ahead and do that, Athens. That's fine.
They care about the Peloponnese, basically.
They care about the Peloponnese, exactly.
Right, and they always want to be the big power there.
Yeah. Now, you know, nobody knew this was the end of the Persian Wars, okay? Because although the idea of the Persians coming back immediately, probably nobody expected that after completely destroying their navy and their infantry. You surely thought the Persian Empire has enough resources to come back eventually, right? So it's perfectly fair to say that the Athenians, in doing what they do over the next 4 or 5 years, which is build up, you know, what becomes the Athenian Empire, that one reason for that was that if the Persians come back, we need to be able to prepare. We need to be able to defend against them.
Consolidated defense.
Consolidate the defense. And also, Thucydides says that the Athenians had it in mind to punish the Persians for what they had done. You know, Athens had been sacked twice. Okay, so I'm sure there were a lot of Athenians running around going, yeah, we're going to show those Persians, you know, and probably other Athenians going, hey, you know what? I think let's declare victory here, guys. You know, trying to show the Persians maybe isn't the best idea.
Yeah, you can see the logic of it.
Of course, both those positions are going to be out there and all kinds of range of positions between them. All kinds of debates are going on about what we should do now that this is over. But the Athenians had been trying to get a hold of the Hellespont for 100 years and had, you know, very great influence and power there. So they clearly grab that back as soon as they can.
Go ahead. Sorry.
The Greeks decide now to dedicate, to make a dedication to the god at Delphi, Apollo, in honor of this victory over the Persians. I want to emphasize a fact. Only 31 Greek states fought against the Persians. There were hundreds of Greek city-states.
Right.
Many of them were neutral. Many of them joined the Persians when the Persians showed up with their army. Understandably so. You know, they just said, we're not going to fight.
They didn't want their city sacked, right? In other words.
We're little, you're big, you know, okay. 31 out of hundreds of Greek states fought against the Persians. The Greeks, they built this tripod. Well, it's you've probably seen the picture. It's intertwining serpents. It's three intertwining bronze serpents.
Right. I've seen it.
It was dedicated at Delphi. It had a golden tripod on the top of it. It was eventually carried off to Constantinople, where it is now. But there's a replica of it in Delphi. But Pausanias dedicated this with his own name on it. Pausanias of Sparta dedicates this to the gods, right? Yeah. And the other Greeks said, hey, man, that's not cool. You know, and they took Pausanias' name off and they inscribed the names of the 31 states
that had New York area listeners. That's what's going to happen to the Governor Cuomo Bridge over the Tappan Zee, which is going to go back to be calling the Tappan Zee now.
Yeah. Is that really the case?
It's really the case. Wow, it's named after the father. Same after Mario Cuomo during the reign of the now disgraced son.
Wow. You know? Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. Well, Pausanias is going to be disgraced too. So you anticipate
right
story. But so ended the Persian Wars, and the West was able to continue to develop outside of Persian control. I think we live in a different kind of world because the Greeks won that battle.
I agree. We're up on our final break. We'll be right back. We're the historians. I have a question for you about this on the other side, and then we'll go over to the news.
Okay, the Cuomo thing was hilarious.
That's true. Everyone hates this Governor Cuomo bridge thing, so they're going to change the name. Now that this guy's gone and his family's in disgrace, they're going to change it to the back to the Tappan Zee Bridge.
Oh, my gosh. Everybody's getting canceled. So we'll go 523 plus 14, so that gives us to 537.
It's to 537, right? Yeah,
537. Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
All right, we're back. For information on the Historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com. The Persian Wars are over.
Well, that's the question I wanted to ask you. Two things. Did they continue to skirmish with the Persians in Asia Minor? And I think the answer to that is yes, correct?
What the answer to that is that the Athenians early in expel Persians from the area north in northern Greece. There's still Persians up there. They get rid of them. There's no fighting in Asia Minor until about the year 467, about 10 years later, when the Battle of the Eurymedon is fought, a very large battle where the Greeks under Cimon defeat the Persians.
Do they see that as just a continuation of their war and the efforts to intervene in Egypt, which come, you know, shortly
just
thereafter?
After that. Yep, exactly.
Right. Do they see that just as a continuation of this war against Persia?
That's a really interesting point, because the Egyptian campaign probably should be seen in that context, because the Egyptian campaign, which started in 460 BC, was because some Egyptians had revolted from the Persians. So the Athenians were essentially sending their aid against the Persians.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that the answer to that is yes. They saw these as continuing hostilities against the Persians. Meanwhile, they were consolidating their control over other Greeks, which is a story I think we should pick up in another arc at some point, the rise and fall of the Athenian Empire.
I think that would be fabulous. And I think that's one of the things our listeners can look forward to in 2022. All right. We definitely need to do that, because there's three twos in 2022. So we must do that.
All right.
Right now, though, we are turning to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News, my favorite segment.
Issue 1, obituaries. Iwo Jima Marine commander dies at 102. Dave Severance, the Marine company commander whose troops planted the American flag on Iwo Jima during World War II in that famous image, a moment captured in one of the most iconic war photos in history, has died at age 102.
Wow.
Yeah, this is from the Boston Herald, I guess. But yes, he died in San Diego in La Jolla. But I also wanted to bring that up. Again, it's the death of the marathon fighters, in other words, the World War II generation. And also just again to remark that we are at the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack and its immediate aftermath. Yeah. It is not forgotten by us. We are the children of the generation that fought that war or lived through that war. And it's something that we're both very aware of how important it is to us and how it has shaped our lives and the veterans who lived through it and the families that lived through it. Yeah. We think that it is, something that we keep in mind as we go through life. It's just something that shaped our lives. I did want to call people's attention to this issue about finance. Of course, there's a tremendous amount. I think we're going to try to do something, some kind of history treatment of the origin of the modern financial system in the 20th century.
Ooh,
we need to.
That sounds good.
We need to attend it. If only our leaders would do that course, that show. I hope they'll be listening to us. But what this piece is from a woman named Jillian Tett, who writes of the Financial Times. And the title of the piece is, "We Need to Talk About Soaring Global Debt. Both private debt and national debt, it's gone beyond. It's insane."
Okay, Brendan, the way you've been on demographics for the last 12 years,
yeah, I know.
I've been on debt. Okay.
I know. But one of the interesting things about this, and there's been a tremendous amount in there about debt, about cryptocurrency and these efforts to establish state currencies outside state control, which I think are doomed to failure. I think it's all speculative. It'll collapse. I also think the efforts to dislodge the dollar as the global reserve currency, what's going to happen with that remains ambiguous to me. That depends on the sort of trajectory of the American state in the globe, which at the moment is not all bright. I mean, it's a very difficult time, even though we're sort of often don't ignore it. But I did think this one piece was funny. It was by a guy named William Walker. And it's like, "Nixon taught us how not to fight inflation." Do you remember the efforts to fight inflation under
wage
Nixon?
And price controls?
Right. Whip actually, inflation now. Remember that?
Nixon did exactly the same thing the Emperor Diocletian did in 301 AD, which was to say you can't charge more than X for this. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, that never works, anyone.
No, it didn't
never
work.
Never works.
Yeah.
Now, I know our listeners have been denied since we've been on a long hiatus. Mm. And I know the one sub-episode that they've been dying to hear.
Huh.
Is it McConvalon style? No. Is it five things in 60 seconds? No. It's Animal Update, our subsection on animals. All right. Now, in Australia, of course, they've got all kinds of problems with invasive species that come from the 18th
yeah,
century.
Yeah, they're called politicians.
No, they're called rabbits, you know, foxes, all kinds of crazy stuff. This one, though, this is a piece from The Economist, June 26th. No more Mr. Mice Guy instead of Nice Guy. So they're Australian. Some of the islands, you know, off the coast of Australia that are in the part of Australia, they have terrible mice problems. They were brought there by European shipping in the 17th and 18th century, and these mice are like everywhere. So now Australia has decided, and I quote the subtitle, Australia Mulls Biowarfare Against Unwanted Critters. And they're basically trying to eliminate these, you know, introduced species in order to, you know, restore the native Australian species.
The answer to this is quite simple.
Cats.
You import cats.
No, Australia has a terrible problem, in all seriousness.
I know the rabbit problem. I knew about the rabbits.
But with cats, wild cats that have gone feral and like eating all the local species of birds and stuff, some of whom can't fly. And these cats, yeah, there's a huge cat issue in Australia.
They don't eat mice, apparently. That's unfortunate.
If you have a juicy bird, why would you run after a mouse that can't fly?
Good point.
This is another piece. The world's heaviest moth, so big it can't fly, has been spotted in Australia.
Was this an obese moth or is it a species?
Yeah, it's basically a moth with a weight control problem.
It's a glandular issue, Brennan.
It's something like that. Yes, it's a gland issue, something like that. There's also a series of pieces that have run in the British newspapers, primarily about urban foxes in England, which I know they're in London. They're all over them. We've seen them. You and I have both seen them in Providence. I've seen them, and I've seen them here in Boston as well. These foxes move in. Yeah. To a neighborhood, and cats start disappearing, all kinds of stuff attack.
Right.
There's also been cases in the U.S. and in Britain of foxes attacking people, like on the street and stuff. Two more animal updates. There's one here about which I've been meaning to talk about forever. Of course, at one time, China was parts of Africa, I mean, in terms of it was tropical and it had elephants and tigers and all kinds of stuff that have disappeared. And there's one area in the border on the southern border of China that still has wild elephants. Well, a group of them decided like, okay, we're getting confined here. And like it went out and wandered around China. And what happened is people in China got really caught up with it. So the authorities were like, okay, no, we're not going to hurt the elephants because they had so many supporters. And they like marching over bridges. They went into cities and they were like marching all over the place, these elephants. It was absolutely fantastic. I urge our listeners to go online and look into this because it really is fantastic. I mean, what happened with these elephants?
Are we sure there wasn't a circus somewhere missing elephants?
No, they're wild elephants, but people started liking them. Now, two quick ones. Aggressive bird showing up in Arkansas is an invasive species of geese from Africa.
Yep.
Now, I had forwarded this to you before. Yep. These geese that are wild African geese have gotten loose. And for some reason, listeners, they want to live in Arkansas. Now, that's not the strange part. Arkansas is a lovely state. Jerry and Yvonne, if you're listening, I know you love it down there.
That's great.
The weird thing about this is the government of Arkansas will not allow the local residents to open fire on these geese and eat them.
I mean, Arkansas is one of the world's most famous duck hunting locations, okay? People travel from all over around the world to go to Stuttgart, Arkansas, and to hunt mallards, okay? I don't understand why they won't unleash the Arkansas duck hunting population on these invasive geese.
Governor of Arkansas, unleash the potential of the people of Arkansas. They have weapons. That's why they're all buying assault rifles to handle these ducks.
I'm sure that those geese could be prepared in a very savory, delicious fashion, too. You know,
according to that piece, which is from the Reuters, I think, those geese, the Arkansas officials are claiming those geese don't taste good. Well, that won't stop the local population. How would they know? Right out. Exactly. Finally, our last piece from Animal Update before we proceed. Here's what to do if you see a wild turkey. This is from the Asbury Park Press, which is a New Jersey newspaper, local newspaper. Mm. Here's what to do if you see a wild turkey. Hint, don't chase it. You know, some people were chasing them. The turkeys were attacking people in New Jersey from my home state.
They'll turn on you.
Yeah. Oh, they're nasty, those things. Yeah. I'm telling you right now, if I could have my way. You know,
I love them. I love turkeys for some reason.
They're beautiful birds, but the idea that they're not nice. You know what I mean? They're just not nice. I mean, they're not. There's just something unnice about your average turkey.
Well, I have a lot of them around my cabin here. So,
yeah, I know. But the thing is, today we were talking in my class about the state of nature, and people were saying, like, well, you know, we can't just start hunting again. In the back of my mind, I was thinking, there's a lot of geese and turkeys out there. Go ahead, start hunting.
Why would they say we can't start hunting again? We are animals, part of this ecosystem. This is what humans have done. They participate in the ecosystem.
Right. I mean,
we're top-end predators. I mean, that's what we are.
Right. I mean, not only that, but you're getting rid of something that's pretty annoying. Those wild turkeys and geese are annoying. Yeah. I wanted to note here, again, on a much more serious note, which I brought up in our earlier episode. This is a piece from the CNN. Vandals deface tunnels near Idaho's Anne Frank Memorial with anti-Semitic graffiti, including swastikas.
Oh, good grief.
I'm not putting up with this stuff, this sort of rampant sort of return of anti-Semitism. I am sick and tired of people doing this stupid stuff. They should be prosecuted. It's wrong. It's ugly. It's inappropriate. I could be here all day. You know, I mean, it really is.
Well, Brendan, if you cancel the 20th century, what are you going to get? One of the things you're going to get is a rise of anti-Semitism. Because that's one of the lessons we're not paying attention to.
Right. We're not being forced to learn or to properly contextualize the Holocaust and earlier episodes of anti-Semitism. Right. If you don't study history and don't know what it's about, you can't figure out how wrong it is, you know? There's another piece which is related to this, not related directly, but this is called, but it is related to this issue of historical studies. It was in The Economist in July, the history wars, the fight over critical race theory in schools is part of a century-long battle over whose version of America is to be taught. There's a lot of truth to that. That's where we're fighting. I mean, fighting over how to interpret the American past. I mean, that's a lot of it.
What people believe about the past controls what they do in the present. Not what happened in the past, but what people believe happened in the past. And the present often controls what people believe happened in the past. So it's crucial.
Right. And it becomes the basis of political action, moral action, ethics. Yeah. And of course, in our country, just as in other countries, there is just a really serious cleavage and debate over what should be done and what should be taught and how it should be taught. And you know, there's different parties to this, but it has become a kind of crisis. Not a crisis is the wrong word, but it's become very heated and sort of, you know, difficult.
Politics are driving it, Brendan. It's quite obvious that that's the case.
I know politics
place of scholarship and the way you and I think about historical scholarship, which is that we're actually asymptotically trying to reach something like the truth.
It has fallen out of any usage, or, you know, people, you know, say, well, that's not legitimate. There is no truth, or there is, you know, it's only my truth. That's the phrase people like, as if all 8 billion of us can have our own history and our own truth.
Yep.
I did not want to mention here, before we close out, the continuing influence of Robin Lane Fox.
All right, Robin Lane Fox.
The physics and the fizz. Robin Lane Fox, because of his new book, has had two pieces in about medicinal style plants. And one of the things he really points out in this fabulous piece from August 22nd in the Financial Times is that looking at the historical gardens of London, you can see that many of the plants that are you know, supposedly attractive plants, actually originally had medicinal value. It's a brilliant little piece.
Wow.
But we're going to have to stop there. We'll be back soon to discuss Robin Lane Fox and all matters historical. We are the historians.